Hello and welcome to our July edition of the Soapbox Podcast. Today,
Crossbox Podcast, jeez.
The Crossbox Podcast.
It's been too long since we've done one of these, clearly.
Right, yeah. So, the July edition of the Crossbox Podcast, which is hosted on the Soapbox. And this is going to be our Armed Services Salute, which may or may not become an annual thing.
We'll see.
All right, so I'm your host, John, with my co-host,
Jay.
And as we said, today we're talking about the armed services, and we're going to talk about something for every one of the armed services, even the lame coasties.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to spoil it, but it turns out they're a little bit less lame than we may have thought at first.
Right, yeah. Right. But not too much less lame.
Right.
This is the Coast Guard.
It is the Coast Guard.
They paint their ships white.
Yeah. Well, I don't really have much in the way of news or positivity, so I think we should just dive right in, huh?
We should. So first, let's talk about the Navy.
Anchors Away. It's one of my favorites.
It really is a good song. So, but yes, the Navy, today we're actually talking about the Navy's, well, the Navy / Marines, America LHAs.
MRCA.
MRCA. MRCA class. Awesome.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, they look from the outside like just your standard old amphibious assault ships, right?
Right.
But on the inside, at least the first couple are very different because they have nearly a full-length hangar deck.
Yeah. What else has a full-length hangar deck? Almost like an aircraft carrier.
Well, yeah, they're not aircraft carriers, of course. Then you go a little bit further down, and where you would ordinarily find the well deck in an amphibious assault ship, you find nothing, like crew spaces and whatnot.
Oh, wait, no well deck.
Yeah.
How amphibious are these ships?
Well, not super amphibious, as it turns out.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wait, but they have a full-length hangar deck.
Yeah, they can carry helicopters. You can put Marines ashore with helicopters.
Ah, that's true, you can. Helicopters are cool.
But really, that's not what they're for.
No, they're for F-35s.
Yes, they're for F-35s because the Marines want aircraft carriers, but they can't get Congress to actually buy them proper aircraft carriers.
Right. And, you know, it's a shame, too, because the America-class LHA is about as big as everybody else's aircraft carriers.
Yeah, it's
in terms of tonnage.
Properly carrier sized.
Yep.
But it's kind of a compromise ship for both missions when you get right down to it.
Yep.
It's not a great amphibious assault ship because, you know, it lacks any amphibious ships support.
Yeah.
It
has any no amphibiosity. Yeah,
has no amphibious support capability.
Right.
And I suppose you could tie better landing ships up alongside it, and then they could, you know, be supported by it in some.
Yes.
Some way.
That seems needlessly complicated. And involves a lot of rope.
And it's kind of a compromised aircraft carrier because it has to carry an awful lot of Marines and all their stuff. And then
doesn't have that angled deck.
Right. Some helicopters to schlep them aboard. No angled deck, no arresting gear, no catapults.
Right.
So you're limited to Harriers and F-35s. And
the F-35 is way better than the Harrier.
It is.
That's kind of a nice segue.
I don't know. I feel like it's a little bit early. Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
You're right. But yeah, so they're really great little ships. Well, little only when compared to the Nimitz's.
Yeah, little, like, what, 50,000 tons.
That's little.
Yeah, at least for American carriers.
Right.
And it's a good capability to have. I mean, I'm not complaining.
No.
Especially as our jump jets get more and more capable.
Right.
I think it's a good thing for the Marines to have. Basically an aircraft carrier that they can deploy in support of other aircraft carriers, or even a little bit on its own nowadays.
Right. Yeah. No, they're solid. But again, really would like if they had like a proper angled deck, or I don't know, but definitely the angled deck.
Yeah.
Maybe some catapults.
Now it is worth noting that the more recent Americas have kind of moved a little bit away from the purely aircraft carrying thing. I believe they've got more amphibious stuff. I don't think they put a well deck in, but they've got more like marine support stuff and more room for small craft, and I think slightly smaller hangars, like the LHA 6 and 7
right,
are the aircraft carrier hubs, and the next block is going to be a little bit more amphibious assaulty. Which, I don't think that's necessarily bad either.
No.
You deploy them in pairs and suddenly you have like the Marine Expeditionary Unit and right, an aircraft carrier together, right, and you're deeply integrated. And that seems like it's kind of a handy thing to be able to park off the coast of somewhere and say, hey, cut it out.
Yeah. No, their aircraft carriers are wonderful, even little ones.
Yeah.
Just funny, though, because they don't get a lot of love from the Navy, but in literally anyone else's Navy, they'd be, like, their pride and joy.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, we just build, like, you know, a dozen of them. It's just, yeah, like, we've still got, like, I think probably 10 or 12 wasps that have to...
Right, they got a bunch of wasps.
And those, yeah, they don't support the F-35 operations quite as well, but, I mean, we've got a ton of Harriers we fly off of them. And
right.
Basically, I guess the fact that the America is more of the same, I think we approve of that idea.
Yep. No, it's a quality thing. And again, I mean, the rest of the world's Navy, China's basically trying to build something of similar size and air wing as the Americas, except with a ski jump and an angled deck and a lot more Russian-ness to it.
Yeah. Well, because that's just what they know.
Well, yeah. Also, if you don't have, like, the second largest air force in the world at sea, you kind of... and not a ton of escort ships to go with it, you kind of need to put missiles in your carriers, and that eats away at airplane space.
Well, you said one thing just now that that makes me wonder, and that thing you said was ski jump.
Yeah. Right?
And it seems like that's a really easy thing to put onto your little baby carrier.
Right.
That doesn't change its ability to launch helicopters.
Right.
And makes it dramatically more effective launching, you know, fixed-wing aircraft.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's something I was reading a report by some Harrier pilot from the Marine Corps about flying off of one of the British ships.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, holy cow, the ski jump is just so much better because you end up, you know, up in the sky a ways. And then as you're transitioning, there's no serious risk of sinking below the deck.
Right.
Yeah.
No, so that is solid.
Yeah. And it seems like that'd be a really easy... I don't want to say fix, because I don't think the Americas are broken.
No, improvement.
Yeah, it'd be an easy improvement that makes the Americas better at the aviation support mission, which they're clearly designed to be doing.
Right. Yeah. This is an aviation support ship. Make it better at that mission.
Yeah.
With ski jump.
Yeah. Now, as to what we'd be launching off of those ski jumps.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's talk about the F-35B.
That's my other favorite, armed services song.
Oh yeah, no, that's a good one. But yeah, so the F-35B is really a cool little plane.
Yeah, and I don't know. I think I brought this up as part of a previous conversation as we were preparing for this episode, mm-hmm. And it seems to me that the F-35B is kind of despite being the one with the B, it's kind of the headline F-35 model.
It is the most dramatic difference in capability.
Right.
I mean, everybody gets stealth and a fancy radar and all the other electronics, but the Marines basically go from a cut-rate little attack aircraft with Britishness, British glorification.
Well, the AV-B2 could launch AMRAAMs.
Yeah, but it's still
plus, rather,
a lousy dogfight. It's a lousy air.
It's not great. It is very much a compromised design to build to build a vertical takeoff thing. And the F-35... at least the B gets around that by kind of, I don't know, being, I don't want to say a vertical takeoff aircraft first, but certainly being designed from the outset with the idea of being a high performance vertical takeoff aircraft,
right,
or at least supporting that as a variant.
Yep. Because you with the low observability, you want that to carry stores internally. And what that means is if you reduce the size of the biggest bombs you fit from 2,000-pound class to 1,000-pound class, you can actually fit the lift fan in pretty easily.
Yeah.
Which is really cool.
It kind of flows from that internal stores carriage thing.
Yep.
And I think it's frequently said that the F-35 is the shape that it is because it had to have a lift fan. And
that's false.
Right. And as John was saying, well, if you look at the F-22, it's kind of got that same hull shape.
Right.
Like a central core, then lots of room on the sides for weapons bays. And that's kind of what you have with the F-35.
Right. And again, the F-22, if you look at it, it's thinner, but it still has a lot of fuel and it only carries really small bombs, right? The F-35, you can put a 2,000-pound JDAM in there, in each bay with room for an AMRAAM as well.
Well, in the A's and C's.
You're right, in the A's and C's. And that's not nothing. That's a lot of, you know, internal volume that you have with clearances for all the wing surfaces. That's a lot of internal volume you get to eat up, plus the fact that it's absolutely stuffed to the gills with fuel.
Yeah.
One of my favorite things to talk to joke with Jay about is, you know, if you look at Navy fighters, the F-35C or even the A model has way more fuel than a Tomcat, even though you wouldn't think
you wouldn't have guessed. Yeah,
you wouldn't guess it. Look, sitting there on the tarmac. But no, the thing is just packed to the gills with fuel.
Well, it's kind of got, like, if you look at it from the front, it's kind of got almost like a bulging look to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like a little bit over square on the top and a little bit over square on the bottom. And that's just, they put fuel tanks everywhere.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's made of fuel and a bomb bay.
Yeah. Which, maybe that's not the best thing for survivability in the long run. But, you know, we'll figure that out and we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
Anyway,
it has its own jammer from that giant radar and it is stealthy.
Yeah. So it's got those things going for it. Yep. And again, it's hard to overstate how much of an improvement it is from the Harrier as far as
is it ever
capabilities go. It is also, you know, much bigger. So it's hard to park it on smaller current ships. But happily, the Navy just bought this giant class of new aviation support ships.
Right. Oh, wow. Yeah. What a coincidence.
Yeah. And you can, I think there are hull diagrams out there that fit. And they show you like 20 or 30 F-35s packed into an America class hangar and then parked on the deck too. And,
wow. That's, you know, the pride of some loser's Navy.
Yeah. We'll put a link to that in the description, I think.
It's a good image. It helps to visualize what we're talking about.
Like just really wing. how big the Americas are, and then
how big the F-35 is too.
Yeah, I'm going to see if I can find a Wasp or a Tarawa deck plan.
Yeah.
And put it side by side to the same scale.
Right. Yeah. Just get that like no, these things are really friggin' huge.
Yes, enormous, gigantic. Yep. Yeah. So.
Yeah, no, Bravo Zulu Marines, you got a great new fighter coming your way.
Yeah, and I'm not going to say cheated, you kind of snuck your way in to the, like the big service procurement plans and said, well, you could also make it go up and down, you know, vertically for us, and everyone just seemed to take that at face value, and now, again, you probably got the best upgrade of anybody.
Right, or certainly the most significant, because definitely, I mean, there's a lot of good stuff in the F-35, but the late model Vipers or Super Hornets are still have a lot more multi-role capability than a Harrier does. Not more effective multi-role capability.
I think in previous conversations we talked about it, the other two variants, and came down in favor of the C model, actually, which might be a little bit surprising to our regular listeners and at least John's huge focus on land-based air.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know. Well, hey, no, yeah, I'm getting there. I'm getting there. Reach out a bit. I mean, also with the C, I really think that it should have been a two-variant plane and make the Air Force and Navy agree on stuff. They did before with the Phantom. We can do this again.
Yeah. The Phantom turned out to be one of the all-time greats. And I think like an F-35 AC could have been up there too. I think the major problem is probably compromise on the gun, honestly.
Yeah, but honestly, I'm okay without the gun.
Yeah.
Which is, I don't know, it's weird for the longtime readers or people who've plumbed the archives, but I've come around to, I'm okay with no gun on this thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, the old modern missiles are much better than they used to be.
Right. And if you look at, like, the Vietnam, it's only the F-4Es that the Air Force had. The Navy never put guns on their Phantoms because they wanted the bigger radar. It's only the Air Force F-4Es that had them, and the gun wasn't like this magic bullet, if you pardon the pun, that got you a lot more kills. It was the focus on dogfighting, you know, and the Navy did better than the Air Force when they had the better training. But again, Navy or Air Force, you still have most of the kills being missile kills because that's what you fought with. You have lots of them. They're good. They let you reach out and touch stuff.
Yeah.
And again, they're better now than they were.
Yeah, so the Sidewinder X can can do things hitherto undreamed of by air-to-air missile designers.
Exactly. So I really don't see the need for the gun, and I'm okay with deleting it since it gets me more fuel, which is range. And I love long-range fighters.
Yeah, and if it's really proves to be something that that we miss, you can always pot it and put it back on.
Right. You know, or you can make a variation. Again, they did that with the F4 when they decided, maybe we do want this.
I do think that might be a little bit harder in the modern day than it was in the past.
Yes, we just have, that just means we throw more money at the problem.
Yeah.
Come on, buy your shares in Lockmart before you make the announcement, dude. God.
Investment advice is not guaranteed.
Yeah, I know, right?
Future, or past performance is not guaranteed future returns.
What past performance?
Well, I mean, if you look at companies that have been around for a long time, Lockheed Martin's. Well, yeah. The components of Lockheed Martin are up there.
Oh, indeed. Indeed. They do a lot of good stuff. And again, I'm a pretty huge fan of the F-35. Despite all its detractors.
Yeah.
And I've got a great post about why I love it. And I'll probably do some more about that because, you know, people keep bitching about it.
Yeah.
Ignorantly. It's the ignorant bitching I hate.
We'll put that post in the show description, too.
Yeah.
I was going to say, the other day I was reading an article about was it some dinner in, like, the early 1990s in Washington, where basically the Defense Department got together with the leaders of a bunch of defense contractors and said, look, we're going to go hard on this peace dividend thing. And so we're going to close down basically all of you, or, you know, we're going to buy a lot less. So you should all merge to, get together. I think it might've been in one of Commander Salamander's articles at the US Navy Institute blog. And basically, if you look at the carrier air wing in the mid-1980s versus the carrier air wing in the mid-1990s, you go from, five manufacturers to two.
Right.
And I think that's something that probably caused some trouble in procurement, at least, because you have so few choices if you want a modern warplane.
Right.
You can go to Boeing, or you can go to Lockheed Martin, and Boeing's kind of out of practice.
Right.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it could be worse. The French have one. If you want a new French aircraft, you're going to ask Monsieur Dassault, and you're going to like his price. And if you're in Britain or Germany, well, you basically have to suck it. Because you have
Britain and Germany, right?
Yes, yeah, you have to combine and argue together with the other one and hate each other's football team and all that other nonsense.
Yeah. It is really, though, just an indication of falling defense budgets everywhere. If you look at Sweden, they have... They don't build everything internally. I think they have the potential that they could. You know, engines.
A lot of the subsystems on the Gripen are imported, but the design is theirs.
They still have the fundamental airframe design capacity and manufacturing capacity natively to build that. And they're 7 million Swedes.
Yeah.
So really, Britain and Germany, you guys have no excuse.
No.
And even France. I mean, France is also up there with being good at having a native defense industry. But given the size of them, they should have way more than the Swedes. And they don't have all that much more than the Swedes.
Nope.
Yeah.
Nope. All right. Speaking of aircraft, and we did mention the Air Force, which is as good a segue as we're going to get. Let's talk about that bomber.
That is, yeah.
Bomber.
Yeah. The aircraft formerly known as Long Range Strike Bomber, or LRS-B, the documents called it, and now known as the delightfully 1930s B-21 Raider.
Oh my God, I love the name. The name is awesome. B-21 Raider. Yeah. Also, homage to the Doolittle Raiders.
Yep.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, you can't go wrong with that. It's really an excellent name.
Right.
I'm not going to fault the Air Force in this latest for that.
Nope.
And really, I think I kind of came into this segment prepared to slam the Air Force for yet another vaporware project. And then I went and did some reading on it and found out that it's actually much further along than I thought.
Yep.
Yeah. So there's an article also in the show description talking about how the B-21 Raider is supposed to be entering testing at Edwards Air Force Base in the next couple of months. And that article was from March. So it's possible they're already flying it.
Yep.
And really, like, when was this project announced? It was like 2014.
Yeah, no, yeah. They've been quietly motoring along on something they deeply, deeply want.
Yeah, when was the F-35 announced? Like 1998?
Right.
Yeah.
Though part of that, too, is that a lot of the technology in the F-35 was new.
Yeah, and I think, well, that's really, it supports our frequent thesis that what you should do is build the state-of-the-art today and not build tomorrow's state-of-the-art today.
Right.
Because you end up building tomorrow state-of-the-art tomorrow, or maybe like the day after, depending on how the science shakes out and how far along you got before the state-of-the-art advanced past what you'd done already.
Also, if you look at any of the read the article, look at any of the pictures, the B-21 is clearly a B-2,
yep, kind of follow
2.0 yeah. or follow-on, or however you want to put it. So there's a lot of, you know, knowledge that you've done this before and how to improve it, and this is Northrop Grumman's bread and butter.
Yeah.
Is building a giant stealthy batarang to drop bombs on people's heads.
I like that. I like that description.
That's batarang a good description. Of doom.
Yeah.
Yep.
So yeah, I think that's there's not a ton to say because it's a hyper classified kind of.
Yeah, it's super secret right now. But I think the most interesting thing for us to say is that we're cautiously optimistic about it for once.
Yeah, it does look like the Air Force at present, at least. I don't want to get too far ahead of myself.
Let's not jinx them.
Yeah. But there's at least a chance that the Air Force is going to hit their 2025 entry into service date, which has been pretty much the entry into service date since the beginning of the project.
Yep.
And
yep. They've had a target date in mind. They appear to be sticking to it. So good on them.
Yeah, it could enter the pantheon of successful procurement projects along with the likes of the Virginia class and the Super Hornet.
Yep.
Yeah.
And the Abrams.
And the Abrams, yeah.
Yep.
That's a little bit further back, though.
Right.
Like, I guess in the modern pantheon, you've got like the Virginia and the Super Hornet.
Yeah, that's fair. That's true.
Yeah.
But yeah, so no, good on you, Air Force. We salute you.
Yep. As part of our armed services salute.
Let's get to the army.
Now
big army.
The correct lyrics to this are, and the caissons go rolling along. Right?
Damn yes. Straight.
Don't listen to anybody who tells you otherwise. The army has ruined their song for the sake of being easy for the new recruits to learn, because they can't be bothered to figure out, to look up or to be taught what a caisson is.
Ah, lazy drill sergeants is what this is.
Yeah, it's just a failure in education at every level.
Yep,
so,
it's just terrible.
Thumbs down to the army on that.
Yeah, and actually we're going to continue that theme, because once again, the army is failing to appropriately deal with its carbines. If you'll recall, in the 1960s, the army loved the giant brickish lance that's called the M14. That is a piece of garbage. And
no, John, it's not a piece of garbage. You can't understand a finely crafted American weapon system.
It's crap. It is like absolute crap. And I can send you a whole bunch of links as to why it is crap.
We'll put some in the show description.
Thank you to looserounds.com for detailing all of the many reasons why the M14 is a piece of shit. And who bought the M16 first? The Air Force. That's right. The Air Force.
When you're being beaten to the punch of buying a new weapon system by the people whose main use for that weapon system is like the annual marksmanship competition.
Right, yeah. And guarding ballistic missiles in the middle of South Dakota from the possible communist infiltrators, then you have something wrong.
Yeah. Basically, of any of the forces who could have gotten away with using the M14 forever, the Air Force is that one.
Right. Then part two, we fast forward to the 80s. And while I'm not the biggest fan of the M16A2 improvement project, it is an improvement project. It was things that people wanted, however misguided it may be at the time. And who started the M16A2 improvement project? The Marines. Once again, not the Army. So today we have the Marines have the M27 IAR, which is an M4 with some improvements, basically made in Germany. Made here by Germans. You have the SOCOM with their upper receiver group improved with a whole bunch of bits that they found on the open market. The Air Force, once again, is still showing the Army up. They have a new rifle that actually fits in the survival kit of an ejection seat.
Nice.
And it has a really cool breakdown device that lets you take it apart. And that device is basically where the barrel nut is, so between the handguard and the upper receiver. And it breaks apart there, and this keeps your bolt carrier kind of protected from the elements and means it won't fall out. You're also a little shorter this way than if you split conventionally using the pins and between the receivers.
Well, that's again, good if you're trying to pack it into the back of an ejection seat or the, I don't know, the under seat compartment where the survival thing is.
Yeah, a little casey thing. But no, it's a really cool little rifle. It's also neat because they grabbed a, you know, commercial off-the-shelf product for making a cool takedown AR and slapped into service. Oh, and it has a free float barrel.
Again, well done, Air Force, on your procurement thing.
No, but they looked, they had a need. There, you know, it's ejecting in these areas is pretty crappy. There's a lot of, you know, psychos in the Middle East that we'd rather not be dealing with. It would be great if we had more firepower than a pistol for while they're waiting for people to come pick them up. So we'll make it happen. And they looked at the market and they found some parts and they made, there's Air Force armors that assemble these and you're done. Perfect. The Army, however, is still using their classic M4s, still with the same unfree-floated handguards that they had in 2003, the Knights Armament RAS, rail accessory system, which is overpriced and kind of garbage now because it's short and not free-floated and terrible.
To be fair, it's not like not like Uncle Sam worries much about price.
No, but like, you know what else you could buy for the same cost as a RAS?
Two other handguards?
Yes, that would be better in every possible way. Right, you've got like a ton of great options, and really what they should be doing is piggybacking on somebody else's project if they can't be arsed to do it themselves. Like, you know, the Marines and the Army should really be getting together and making a rifle happen again, or just buy what I'll have what SOCOM's having, but slightly simpler, or whatever. But Army, you need to get your act together. I know carbines aren't the most important thing in the world, but you can make some modernizations. It's really embarrassing when the Marines are doing all kinds of cool experimental projects with kind of making an automatic rifle for everyone. You know, just general issuing the M27 to all riflemen, playing around with variable power, low power variable magnification optics, playing around with silencers for everyone in the squad. The Marines are doing all this with a much smaller budget.
Yeah. Well, the Marines are also, I think, much smaller in the first place. And that's one of the problems with procurement for the Army is that just in terms of personnel, there's so much to, like, so many people to whose gear you need to replace.
Right. Well, you can do it in phases.
You can, and it's just that there's a great deal of organizational inertia there, much more than there is for the Marines.
Yeah, that's where the big problem is, the inertia. Because you could do what they did originally, which was they bought the M4s, the infantrymen decided we really like those, the infantrymen got them, and the support guys got the hand-me-down M16A2s. Mm-hmm. You know, you could do this kind of phase replacement. But just something, show that you have noticed all of the millions of dollars the civilian market has done for you in developing better weapons.
Yeah. And it's really something that it couldn't have been anticipated back in the day, but when the AR platform civilian rifle really exploded, you get so much free development work done.
Right.
And not in combat conditions, granted, but a lot of it still in like stressful and kind of high intensity situations and on the competition circuit.
So. Right. And you can actually find, you know, on the market, the nicer made stuff is good enough. If you look at the URGI, ERGI, whatever you want to call it, that's all commercial stuff. Right. Yeah. I think the barrel is something special for them to work with M855A1, but it's still a Daniel Defense barrel. It's pretty similar to the ones you can buy on the market. The Geisley rail has a couple minor improvements. It's just like all the other Geisley rails on the market. All the stuff there, you can build a pretty good clone yourself, right, in terms of, and you could have built it 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Right? All the stuff was developed by other people. It was funded by other people's money. SOCOM picked the parts they liked, asked for a couple changes, and called it a day, and they're probably having beers and laughing it up down at Fort Bragg.
Yeah.
So then that's, I think, my biggest complaint, is that there's a lot of development out there that has gone on for free. The Marines with the M27, you know, the HK416 was originally developed for Delta Force in the late 90s and early 2000s. And the Marines tried it out and decided they liked it. Again, this was somebody else's development money, filling in a contract. One of the neat things about the 416, it is kind of heavy, but it met all of the Marine, like, sustained fire requirements of the IAR project as is. They just, HK was smart, put USMC on the side. Good thinking.
Very much so. And I think it's worth repeating that, I guess the Marines and the Air Force are kind of the big winners in procurement so far.
Yep.
At least At least as far as this year's Armed Services Salute goes.
Yeah, no, Marines have done a good job. Though, again, that is an Air Force procure 2, right? The Air Force is also buying the 35A.
Yeah. But
the big win is the big winner is the Marines.
Well, and I think it's well, I guess it's too early to say if the B-21 Raider is going to pan out. But if it does, then that's also a big success.
Right.
But,
and again, a
big success on a headline project too. That's the real thing.
Yep.
It's easy to buy like new night vision goggles because nobody cares about that.
Or new carbines for the Air Force.
Yeah,
to guard the Minuteman silos.
The Minuteman silos are to tuck under the seat of somebody's F-16.
Right. You know? Yeah.
But it is really hard if it's one of your main capabilities, something you have to do and do well to continue to be a functioning fighting service. Then there's the stakes are so much higher, the pressure is higher, and it seems like that's usually a recipe for bad designs.
There's a lot of people who want to get their hands in that kitchen and get involved when it's your bread and butter.
Yeah.
You know, there's like three guys in the Air Force who care about carbines, and they apparently spend a little time on ARFCOM or something, and they know their stuff, and they just got shit done. Yeah. So that was easy. They're like, new rifles? Sure.
Yay. I can do that, yeah. Give me a committee and like $50 million and we'll be done.
Yeah. We'll film Behind Enemy Lines 2 and it'll be so much awesomer.
Look at it go.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, speaking of headline capabilities that are kind of high pressure, that gives us a little segue into our next topic. I'm pretty sure that's the Coast Guard song. That was the only one that I didn't recognize the instrumental song. So.
Yep, Semper Paratus. That's right. It's not a bad song, actually. It's just
underplayed. You never hear it because... Yep. Well, maybe something like the 4th of July, if there's a particularly like cosmopolitan director doing that.
Right,
like the,
or he knows a coastie.
Yeah, or was a coastie.
Right. Now, for all of our poo-pooing of the Coast Guard, though, they do have something really freaking cool.
Yeah, right, and we discovered this... at least I discovered this and did my research as part of my previous... post on handicapping the Fast Frigate X contenders.
Yep.
And well, it turns out this was a Fast Frigate X contender, and it was one of those like, oh yeah, they have ships.
Yep. And they're pretty good ships too. This is the Legend class Coast Guard cutter.
I believe it's also sometimes known as the National Security Cutter.
That's correct. Yeah. And I don't know enough about, like, is the NSC, like, LRS-B or whatever, or what? But, yeah, it's the Legend-class cutter or the National Security cutter. They're big, long-range cutters. And when I say long-range, I'm not whistling Dixie. Well, these have, like, what, 12,000?
Okay, I think the stock range is 12,000 nautical miles. And it's the only 12,000. FFGX contender, which, like, whose range for the entry is actually reduced from, like, the stock range.
Yep.
Because they're like, well, we'll take some gas tanks out and put in like all this stuff you guys want.
Yeah.
But even as it is, though, the Legend class is a pretty decent patrol frigate choice.
Yep. No, or Corvette, depending on how you want to call it.
Yeah. It's a little big for a Corvette.
Yeah, but that's okay.
When we say cutter, like we're not talking like, you know, if you say cutter and you're like big into sailing history, you think of like, oh, it's a small fore and aft rigged ship. No, it's actually like... frigate sized.
This is a frigate.
Yeah.
This is basically a frigate. It's not heavily armed like a frigate, but it's a frigate.
It's frigate sized. It's a frigate hull.
Yep. And it's a really nice hull. It handles seakeeping really well. It's got tons of range, which is everything I would want were I buying a Corvette or frigate or whatever you want to call it, a lesser naval combatant to complement the Arleigh Burkes.
Yeah.
It's got a 57mm gun. It's got space reserved for the SeaWiz system of your choice. It's got a helicopter.
Those are the things that you need to make a frigate.
Well, at least for us.
Well, yeah. We've talked this over, and we've decided that what you're trying to build with the little crappy ship is a flag waving patrol frigate, Corvette, anti like sub hunter kind of thing.
Right.
And if you pop a towed sonar on and put on some sea rams, what you have is something that's better than the LCS in basically all of those roles.
Yep. It will go. It has a ton of range and fantastic sea keeping, so you can send it anywhere you like. It's got a 57mm gun, so it can make pirates, you know, remember their pressing engagement ashore, or as fishermen. It's got a C-RAM for, you know, some basic point defense if someone wants to throw a missile at it. It's got a helicopter already, so you just have to, you know, put in instead of rescue gear, torpedoes or something.
Yeah. sonobuoys.
Yeah, sonar. Those things too. Sonobuoys very important. But you can just, again, it carries like a, you know, full-size dolphin, you know, swap for your Seahawk.
It is sufficiently big that I'm sure you could probably pack in a second helicopter without too much trouble.
Yeah, you might actually be able to get a second Whirlybird on there. That's pretty awesome. And that's another big capability jump over
just one. Because with two helicopters, you have... Well, you'd have two helicopters. If one's off doing something, you have a second one to respond to a new threat.
Right. You can also, you know, get sonobuoys in two places at once.
Yeah. Well, you know, helicopters are fast by the standards of warships, but they aren't fast on an absolute sense. It still takes time to go from, say, 40 miles off the port bow to 40 miles off the starboard bow.
Exactly. And you want to be careful because submarines do have high-speed anti-ship missiles and those icky torpedoes.
Right.
So I really do like this ship. I agree with you, though, that even though it would make sense to buy it, if it was my decision, I would buy them for the Navy and tell them to get over it. But the Navy probably won't because they don't want to acknowledge that the Coast Guard did something right for once in their lives.
The Coast Guard exists.
Yes.
So, yeah. I'm sure it's already kind of a thumbing their nose, the Coast Guard at the Navy, by the mere fact of existing. I'm sure the Navy looks at it that way. But then to admit that the Coast Guard built a better ship than you.
Right, and that hurts. Even though this is another one of those times when I'm visited by the ghost of Robert McNamara, and I say, you know, this actually makes a lot of sense because, you know, if you think about the Coast Guard, you're looking for a ship that can stay a long time offshore and deal with heavy seas and, you know, pick up drug smugglers or help mariners in distress. And if you replace the rescue systems with a few light combat systems, you have a ship that can go different places and wave your flag and, you know, do minor missions that, you know, you might need doing.
Yeah. Well, and also don't forget that as an FFG-X contender, the Legend class, like there are now like technical drawings and designs and things for a version with a VLS. Yep. So if you want like that 8-pack of tubes to put stuff in, you have that option. You can get that built too.
There's actually they at a naval show. I'll get the link for the article. They actually showed off Huntington Ingalls, who built the Legend class, actually showed two different versions of frigate. Basically, and one is we're gonna paint it gray and add a CWIS and call it a day. And there's another that was basically the FFGX contender, which has a number of extra systems like the like a small VLS and some other stuff to make it a little more combat worthy if you like it. And it's gotten a lot of interest from navies because have you seen the legs on this thing?
Yeah. It just can go for a long time. And even the FFGX contender, which reduces its range so much, still goes like 7,000 miles on a tank of gas.
Which is really impressive.
Yeah, that's a long way.
Yep. And again, you know, being there's those pesky oceans in the way, we're kind of in the same position Britain was at the turn of the previous century, where we've got a lot of assets in far off places, and range is really important. Sea keeping is important. We have to be able to send things far away and make people remember who America is. World police, that's who we are.
I think the central insight too in why we think the Legend class is okay is that it's not like not every ship has to be able to handle itself in every situation.
No.
Because when you do that, you just end up buying another like 3 dozen Burks,
and right,
Congress might balk at that kind of.
I mean, we do love the Burks, though.
They are really excellent ships, and they do everything pretty well.
Yep.
But at the same time, you can't afford to build a Navy entirely out of Burks.
Right.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
So you have to have something smaller that can do, like, the light combat tasks. So you have to task independently to... Well, it's basically just the classic frigate mission.
Yep.
It's not supposed to stand up to the line of battle.
Nope.
It's just supposed to go places, fight other frigates.
Right.
And, you know,
do basic things.
And go overseas, intimidate colonies, you know.
The deck guard role is another good one for a frigate. You know, somebody who can just hang by a carrier and pick up pilots who ejected because they botched their landing and ferry them back to the carrier for what is probably going to be an awful, miserable day of hazing.
And a new call sign.
Yes.
Hey, drinks.
Yep, exactly. It'd be great. So, yeah, no, they're just wonderful ships. And they really have a nice mix of capabilities for a number of missions. And so Bravo Zulu Coast Guard. Never thought I'd hear myself say that. But you have made a damn fine ship.
And we approve. We approve wholeheartedly.
Yep.
Well, we're only like 35 minutes into this show. So, do you want to talk about our little sub-hunter design, maybe?
Yeah.
What we came up with?
Yeah, I think we should.
So, it came to our attention that... You may not want to send your fancy frigate against your fancy frigate, even your less fancy frigate, against a bunch of submarines, or you might not want to task them all to convoy escort because they've got other things to be doing.
Right.
So what you need is a class of cheap sub-hunters.
Right. Yeah. This is also a ship that you can design with an export eye in mind.
Yes.
Sweden.
Right. So what you want is something
Sweden.
Something small and kind of corvette-shaped, right?
Right.
And you basically slap a really nice towed array on the back.
Yep.
And you slap a helicopter on the deck.
Yep.
And then you're pretty much done. You know, yep. With your classic, your standard defensive fit. Maybe a 57mm gun if you're feeling fancy. Definitely some SeaWiz system of choice.
Right.
And again, you're pretty much done at that rate. Maybe like maybe a towed torpedo decoy too.
Right. Yeah, one of those little decoy systems. But that's pretty easy to fit.
Yeah. Again, it's just it's fairly easy. You just like a big spool for the cable.
Right.
So what does that get you? That gets you a ship that can outrun a submarine, at least a diesel electric submarine.
Right.
Because that's kind of the thing you're aiming to outrun. If you're trying to outrun a nuclear submarine, you're probably in trouble.
You're doing it wrong.
Yeah. And that's not really the foe this ship is designed to attack. I mean, it's kind of sort of a coastal sub-hunter. It's a small ship, one helicopter. Go and find that sneaky diesel submarine that's been hanging off your coast for 2 weeks and then sink it because it's got, you know, it doesn't have a ton of options for fighting back.
No.
Yeah.
And also that submarine is making you look super bad. Again, Sweden.
Again, yeah, Sweden. So, and because your main, like your peer foe is assumed to be a diesel electric boat, you don't need much in the way of speed. Like,
no.
22 or 25 knots, you're fine.
Right. And you're not going to run the torpedo because you can't.
It's a torpedo, yeah.
But they're good at that. But you have helicopters, or a helicopter, and that's your goal.
Yeah.
And thinking like a full Blackhawk on this guy.
Yeah, definitely. And the submarine isn't going to outrun your helicopters, the thing.
No.
So, although a submarine outranges you if you've got like your 2-3 packs of lightweight torpedoes on deck, what happens is if the submarine launches on you from out of your range, you turn the other way and stream your torpedo decoy, then you send your helicopter to along that bearing to find the submarine, which it can do, because it's kind of what helicopters do.
Yeah.
And so you get out to the datum, and either the submarine is going fast to clear the datum, in which case the helicopter can hear it. Or it's going slow to avoid the helicopter, which it can't, because the helicopter's a helicopter, and that's like the bane of submariners everywhere.
Exactly. Yeah. Having played lots of different games, we know the worst thing about being a submariner is a helicopter looking for you that has some notion of where you are.
Like where you are, yeah. And that's what happens when you shoot at somebody.
So. Yep. Yeah, that's pretty obvious.
Yeah. But really, an anti-submarine warfare, it's one of our favorite naval commentators' favorite bugaboos. Commander Salamander writes about it all the time, and how it's expertise that's easily lost and not being well-developed in the West right now.
No.
And a cheap class of sub-hunters gives you a couple of things. It gives you a bunch of new officer berths to, if you want to expand your Navy, it's a cheap way of doing so. And it gets you a large class of officers with a bunch of sea experience, which is good.
Perfect for a center of excellence.
Yes. Yeah. And it gets you a bunch of officers, after you've had them for a couple of years,
who
have a big focus on anti-submarine warfare and aren't likely to forget it in the future.
Right.
Yeah.
Or at least that's the idea. I mean, Britain... Well, you have to basically avoid becoming Britain.
Right.
Is the other key goal. Because Britain had the Type 26 frigates, 23, whatever, the Iron Dukes.
Yeah.
Which are really nice little frigates for the anti-submarine mission. That's about all they can do, but they're good at it. Provided the crew is well practiced. And what did Britain stop doing?
Practice.
Yep. That's what they did. There's a ton of great Salamander articles bemoaning this fact.
Yeah.
But that's that. So so that's how we might build a small ASW ship. Again, small, cheap, cheerful, perfect for the export market or the coastal defense market or all manner of tasks.
Now, another thing you could do with that hull, and this is a concession to one of our recent commenters.
That's right.
Yeah. So when you have a small, fairly slow hull, well, I kind of think Minesweeper, don't
you?
And
I do.
Yeah. So if you've got that development going already, you can just, clear out the anti-submarine sonar, put in like a little high-frequency mine-hunting sonar.
You also put in space for one of those little...
fancy drone jobbers.
Yeah. Which, again, the technology's not there yet, but you want that capability in, now for the future.
Yeah. An idea I discovered. I'm writing an article right now about retro procurement for Luxburg, and in researching this, I came across. Well, I've been reading up on the LPH-2 types, the Iwo Jima amphibious assault ships, the class preceding the Tarawas, and toward the end of their lives, two of those ships were converted to one. One was converted to a mine countermeasure support ship. So it was would embark a bunch of the mine hunting helicopters that the Navy used to have.
Right.
And it would then support a group of the mine hunting ships the Navy still has, but is beginning to retire.
Right. The one thing you might want to do for this, and I know our commenter is going to say it if I don't point it out, but you can do this, just bake it in from the beginning if you're thinking of double rolling it, is you can make it a non-magnetic hull.
Yeah, and that's...
Again, that's not hard to do, but it's something you want to do...
At the beginning.
Early. Yeah. Because it doesn't matter much for submarines, but it does matter for mines.
Well, you actually have a fair bit of a... I don't know how common it is anymore, but you used to have the influence trigger being big on... So you might dodge a torpedo shot that way too if it's like a keel breaker kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So no, but since we're designing this for a dual or a possible dual role, we're gonna want to make the ship at least sort of quiet, depending on how much you want to spend on it, or at least make that you can make the quiet engines an option like the Germans did with the Mako frigates.
Yeah.
You know, you have different like things you can select.
So one of the
Then the non-magnetic hull.
Yeah. One of the things that you could do too, well, we had these wonderful old mine countermeasure support ships back in the day, and what we have right now, we've got a couple of the Tarawa class amphibious assault ships just sitting laid up in ordinary, waiting to be scrapped.
Yep.
So why not bring them back from the dead? So what you have then, you put a bunch of helicopters on those too, and you have depending on fitment and the associated ships, you have either sub hunter groups or mine hunter groups.
Yep,
and that seems like a great. Both of us and like great things to resurrect that we don't have right now be handy to bring back.
Yeah, the helicopter cruiser is decidedly third world tin plate useless Navy, but there's definitely something in there to be played
with. I mean, it's not supposed to be like a main combat unit. It's a support ship, like a sea lane clearance ship, kind of, and that's a valuable
or a harbor clearance ship.
Well, yeah, same kind, like a sea line of communication.
Yeah.
Ship.
Yeah.
And that kind of sea control is something that navies are supposed to do.
Right.
And something that's really easy to forget in between wars when mines and submarines are less of a problem.
Right. No, and I think the other thing you'd want to do is you'd really want to be able to use something like a Black Hawk, even as a compromised anti-mine helicopter, but you'd really want that because that's the helicopter we use for literally everything.
And I don't know, I think that... It's probably not like a cheap mission package to develop, but we already have the airframe and it's not going anywhere. So it's probably a good base to build that on.
Yeah, because that's really what you'd want to be able to do, even if you can't swap. If you have to, I mean, on something like a Tarawa, you could load both.
Yeah, well, you've got like room for 20 or 30 helicopters. So you've got, say, 10 of each and you suddenly have an extremely formidable ship in that sea line control.
Exactly. Role. And remember frickin' Haiphong Harbor or something if you want a relatively modern example.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so that is an excellent idea. I really like that. Be able to range some helicopters on an older hull, as a support vessel for these little, for small mine hunters or sub hunters.
It is. It's kind of something we've gotten away from in the past, I don't know, two decades maybe.
Yeah.
From probably, I guess, the end of World War II up through maybe the 1990s or so.
Yeah.
When a ship class ran out of life, what you did was you brought it back in, fixed it up, and then gave it a secondary role for a while.
Yep.
You know, you had Essexes serving as amphibious assault ships, like the old straight deck ones that didn't convert.
Yep.
You had the Iwo Jimas doing the kind of the same thing.
You had a bunch of them used test vessels.
Yeah.
There's some really cool pictures out there if you look them up of one of the late antebellum battleships. I think it's Mississippi or something being used as a missile test ship, shooting missiles off and experimenting with the design.
Macross style.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's pretty neat. So there's some, battleships that were used to test launch some missiles or, experimenting with missile designs. There's a bunch of ships that were used to test radar suites in the 60s. It's also the kind of thing that we used to sell to allies a lot.
Yeah, there are tons of, well, I guess not so much anymore, but there were tons of World War II and slightly after carriers serving in third world countries.
Right, not just carriers. Yeah. I mean, destroyers,
that's
destroyer
true,
escorts. Actually,
the Philippine Navy is still primarily made of, American World War II surplus.
Yeah, that was the Greek Navy for a really long time. Taiwan is still American surplus, but after World War II.
One of my favorite pieces of living history was actually from the Greek Navy.
Yeah.
Yeah, the LST-325, which is, you know, your standard end of World War II landing ship tank, was sold to the Greeks, and after its long and storied career in Greek service, was purchased by some American veterans who brought it back here to Evansville, Indiana, where it's homeported now, and it kind of makes cruises up and down the Mississippi system, bringing a little bit of World War II living history to you, wherever you are along that place. It was in Pittsburgh a couple of years ago, which is when I saw it, and if it comes back, I'm totally going to go see it again.
Yep. Also, that other ship which you need to go see, the USS Slater.
Yeah, that's still on the list.
Also formerly of Greek service, also formerly in American services.
Yeah. How did they get it to, how did they get it where it is now?
Just I don't recall.
Okay, it's kind of the...
I don't recall. Actually, if I knew, I probably wouldn't tell you to encourage the mystery in you and the need to go visit your namesake.
How did you get this here? Kind of ask that question. Anyway, I think that about that about wraps us up.
I think it does. Yeah. No, we've had a good one here talking about how to fix some of the problems of procurement, or at least procure some better stuff.
Yeah.
We've talked about something for every service, even if it wasn't always positive, but that's okay. They're not always doing good things.
We've also talked about successes. And I think that's we can lose sight of that when we're talking about procurement, because so much of it is just like miserable failure after miserable failure.
I actually want to cut in a little bit here briefly. Because I don't want the Army guys out there to feel like everything in their service is a failure, and I don't want them to bombard me with hate mail. The one thing I will point out that they're doing well that isn't quite as notable as from a blogging standpoint, but they did a great job of just buying the Trophy Active Protection System, putting it on the Abrams, and calling it good.
Yeah.
Finally.
And sometimes when there is a solution out there, the best thing to do is just to buy it.
Yep.
Yeah.
And bolt it on your tanks, even if it makes them uglier somehow.
Yeah.
So that's okay.
Yeah. As we wind this episode down, we'd also like to say thank you to our recent batch of commenters, supposing you're listening. And if you are, we hope you stay around and please send us podcast topics. We'd like to do these, and we sometimes have a hard time of putting down to electronic paper what we're actually going to chat about. So if you've got something you want to hear us talk about, you can just leave us a comment on this or somewhere, and we'll give it some consideration.
All right, we'll bring it up. We can. Yeah. So thank you all for being a wonderful audience, and thanks to our armed services veterans for doing all they do.
Yeah. Cheers to you.
And happy birthday, America.
I think we'd both agree that it doesn't necessarily make you a good person. Like that, you're not necessarily everybody who serves is a good person, but it's still a selfless choice and one we appreciate.
Yep.
So yeah.
Cheers, guys.
Yep. And the Crossbox podcast, which you've been listening to, is produced by my co-host John and me, Jay, and is brought to you by Many Words Press, online at manywords.press. Our theme music is Royal Rumble by Jay Mann of ourmusicbox.com, although we didn't use it this week. It's actually all public domain stuff from various military bands and choirs. So thank you, U.S. military bands and choirs. Those are used under the terms of no license because, as productions of the U.S. government, they're in the public domain. You can keep up with us, the Crossbox contributors between podcasts, at soapbox.manywords.press.